So, hey, everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on with Voices from the Frontlines, your 4 o'clock drive time, walk time, bicycle time, public affairs hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. So today's show is going to primarily focus on a writer and political prisoner named Russell Maroon Schoetz. Next Thursday, not this following Thursday, but the one afterwards, Thursday, May 27th, there's going to be an evening about his book signing that I very much want you to attend. It's going to be at the Southern California Library on Thursday, March 27th at 6:30, and I'll tell you more about it. So for now, I'm going to reread the article I wrote on Trayvon Martin, since the trial is obviously still going on, and some of you asked me to. And then we're going to move into some of the readings, a lot of readings, from his book, Russell Maroon Schoetz's book, Maroon the Implacable. As I told you, we're going to both have a short discussion of the Trayvon Martin case and also talk to you about this political prisoner, Russell Maroon Schoetz. We're going to go to the phones at about 4:40 to get your commentaries on both Trayvon Martin and your thoughts about the trial and to some degree what I wrote. And also to talk about your response to the writings of Russell Maroon Schoetz. And then in particular, since this is called Voices from the Frontlines, we want you to talk about the possibility of bringing people to this event Thursday night, June 27th at 6:30 at the Southern California Library. I'll get you the exact address, but it's basically at Vermont and Gage, and you can look it up on the Southern California Library, but I'll get you the address before we leave. What I'm going to do is start with the article I wrote last week on the opening of the trial that did appear in Color Lines. It also appeared on another black magazine called The Root, which is very nice, and also appeared in Black Agenda Report. So once it showed up on Color Lines, it was taken in the good sense by two other publications, and we had over 1,000 shares of the article, which is pretty incredible. Apparently, the Color Lines, if you go on there, www.colorlines.com, which you should anyway, it's an e-zine, when they hit 1,000, it just didn't go over there, because we hit 1,000 in one day, which is pretty amazing. I mean, it went up about 8 o'clock in the morning, and then it was like 254, and I was speaking in D.C. when I came back and checked Color Lines, was up to like 950. The next morning it hit 1,000, and it stayed at 1,000 since. So most likely more than 2,000 people have taken the article and sent it out to others, and I'd like you to do the same. It's up on, the best place to get it is still on colorlines.com, so I'm going to read it to you now. George Zimmerman is going on trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin, but let's be clear. Within the defense's opening arguments, for many who follow the trial, which will be televised, will be Trayvon Martin who will be on trial. He is, in fact, already. On May 23rd, the Orlando Sentinel offered the following news, so-called article. New evidence in Zimmerman case. Trayvon texted about fighting, smoking marijuana about a week before he was killed. Then this is also from the Sentinel. The evidence that George Zimmerman's attorneys have, quote, uncovered on Trayvon Martin's cell phone paints a troubling picture of the Miami Gardens teenager. He sent text messages about being a fighter, smoking marijuana, and being ordered to move out of his home by his mother. And photos from that phone offer more of the same, healthy green plants, what appear to be marijuana, growing in pots, and a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson handgun. Each time I'm reading it, it's rather amazing, as if this is supposed to be anything. This is my parenthesis here. So here we go again with a script deep in the white American psyche, the impossibility of black innocence. My first experience with the horror of racism was the murder of Emmett Till in 1955. He was only a year older than me when he died. It was alleged that Till, a 14-year-old black boy visiting Mississippi for the summer, did not know his place and whistled at a white woman in a store. That evening, the husband of the woman and his friend came to the house of Emmett Till's grandfather, kidnapped Emmett, beat him beyond recognition, and then drowned his body. When his mutilated body was found, Emmett's mother, Mamie Till, insisted that his casket be left open because, in her words, "I wanted the world to see what they did to my baby." The images shocked the black community and attracted great anger and sympathy from anti-racist people all over the world. And yet, for some, mainly white people, of course, the debate focused on whether Emmett had or hadn't made any flirtatious advances towards the southern white women, with many believing that if so, he had brought his murder on himself, or as a someone would say, "Well, I'm not really saying that's the only factor, but..." When I worked in the Newark Community Union Project in 1966 to 1968 in the city's black South and Central wards, we worked on many community issues, including police brutality. In each case, we worked to identify the facts of the story and document the specifics of the brutality. I still remember George Richardson, a militant black political figure, explained to us his views on the realities of police brutality cases as if it was just yesterday. This is George speaking. "You know, Eric, in these police brutality cases, we're always looking for the perfect black victim, the completely, quote, innocent black man, but he doesn't exist. In our ideal case, a white cop beats or shoots a black man, and it turns out it was a black doctor walking down the street doing absolutely nothing when a white cop comes up to him and beats him badly. But that is never the way it is. The guy usually is poor or working class. He has a criminal record. He was drinking. He talked back to the cop. He ran a traffic sign. He shoplifted. He, quote, resisted arrest. He yelled at the cop. He raised his hand, whether in self-defense or even to fight back. But that has nothing to do with the fact that he was beaten half to death for being black. In every case, the black man is on trial, guilty until proven innocent. And you know what? For most of these folks, even our hypothetical black doctor could never be innocent enough. And certainly our very real Trayvon Martin could never be innocent enough for some people, and hopefully that none of those people are going to be on this jury. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black man-child leaving a gated community and shot down in cold blood, was as close in reality to that hypothetical black doctor as one could imagine, but it did not save him from an early grave. So now, in this important test case, it's essential that the civil rights movement and organizers and communities of color put the system on trial, for this trial is not about George Zimmerman alone, but also about how a system that sanctioned the murder of an unarmed black teenager until mass, national, and international pressure forced a trial. We have to win the argument that there are no extenuating circumstances in the stalking and murder of unarmed black men. And while we are there, we have to win the argument that a pen or a knife or a shopping cart or a parked car or something that looked like a gun are not lethal weapons at 15 feet and that lethal force is not an option by the police. Every time someone raises any questions about Trayvon, and we can be assured that as the trial goes on, the character assassination of Trayvon Martin will escalate, we have to counter with the most radical and structural demands on the system possible. To shift the terms of the debate and put the system on trial, this tactic, which has been called counter-hegemonic demand development, was the great contribution of the civil rights movement is rooted in Frederick Douglass's advice, "Power concedes nothing without a demand." Now we have to roll back all the stop-and-frisk laws, all the hold-your-ground laws, all the war on drug laws, the endless web of laws that have put 1 million black people in prison and millions more in probation and parole. We have to demand that President Obama enforce the 1964 Civil Rights Act and use the statutory power to withhold federal funds from any agency using those funds in a racially discriminatory manner, from Los Angeles to Chicago, from New York to Houston, and everywhere in between. We need to demand the social welfare state, not the police state. 1,000 more buses, 1,000 more teachers, 1,000 more nurses, and 1,000 fewer police. When we say Trayvon Martin did not die in vain, we have to fight for the maximum program that his life and his death and his innocence deserve. This is Eric Mann. I wrote that, and it was published in Caroline's magazine. Before I go to discussing Maroon the Implacable and Russell Maroon Schultz in his new book, I just want to talk to you a little bit more about this concept of counter-hegemonic demand development. What does it mean? We've used it at the Strategy Center since we were formed in 1989, and obviously, as a child of the Civil Rights Movement, I learned it from my teachers. I learned it by reading Frederick Douglass, as I said, from Martin Luther King, from Malcolm X, from Fannie Hamer. But the whole discourse of the black movement was to put the system on trial. And the whole discourse of the country, of course, is to put black people on trial, workers on trial, unions on trial, now teachers' union on trial. And once they put you on trial, I'm sorry, you can never be innocent. You can never win. Because once you're on trial, you theoretically are providing evidence of your innocence. And we shouldn't be providing evidence of our innocence. We should be providing evidence of the total moral and political decadence of our society, which some of us call by the affectionate name of U.S. imperialism. Because the society that we live in is becoming so brutal, so cruel, that we really have to talk about putting the system on trial in every single one of its profound failings. So in this particular case, here are two lives that I'm talking to you about. One is Trayvon Martin, who is deceased, and we're trying to bring his life alive. The second life that we're going to talk about is a man who is in solitary confinement as we speak. He's been moved to Pennsylvania, where he's in the same prison as Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's a brilliant philosopher and political writer, and on June 27th, at the Southern California Library, starting at 6:30, we're going to have an evening to kick off his book, Maroon the Implacable, the Collected Writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. So because I don't do this show to read your nice stories, I read your nice stories to get you to come out and do things. Right now, make a commitment to come out on Thursday night, June 27th, 6:30, Southern California Library, because I'm going to be reading you sections from his book right now. And then afterwards, we have a good time to read, which is great. And then in about 25 minutes, we're going to go to the phones, 818-985-5735. Take your calls, and we're going to discuss the state of the Black Liberation Movement, the Trayvon Martin case, if you'd like to talk about it, your thoughts about probably the first time you've read Maroon the Implacable. And yes, I'm coming out on Thursday, June 27th at 6:30 to the Southern California Library, because that's the punchline, okay? So I'm going to start reading a really excellent book. Now, I'm just trying to think. Jeff has a slight bio of Russell, but I'm having trouble finding it, so I'm just going to go direct to the reading. Russell Maroon Schultz was a member of the Black Panther Party. He was sent to prison for a very militant attack on a police station. He's been in prison since 1972. He's been in solitary confinement for most of those years. He escaped from prison twice with an extraordinary 30-plus years in solitary confinement. And I'm going to particularly focus on this Dragon and the Hydra, a historical study of organizational methods, give you a sense of what this man's thinking is. His basic premise is he believes in decentralized, militant, organized revolutionary groups that do work together in a concerted, coordinated fashion, but he does not support the development of a so-called vanguard party, or in this case, an organizationally unified party. Now, I have different thoughts on that, a lot of very much appreciation for his thinking and other thoughts that might be somewhat different, but right now that's not the point what I think, it's what the point that he thinks, and I want to read some of his ideas to you. All right, so this is Russell Maroon Schultz. He's quoting Karl Marx. You have 15, 20 years of civil wars and people's struggles to go through, not only to change the conditions, but in order to change yourselves and make yourselves fit for political rule. Karl Marx, addressing the International Working Men's Association, a body that would later become the First International. Marx's word hit close to home. I've been involved in such struggles for 40 years, a product originally of the Black Liberation Movement of the 1960s, and subsequently of being held as a political prisoner in the United States since 1972. Over that period, I participated in a number of mass and party formations. It never fails to amaze me how much energy and time is dedicated towards establishing the claims of various groups to be the so-called vanguard of some struggle for justice, when in the end most of these exercises turn out to be sterile, when they don't degenerate into fratricidal conflicts. Further, I'd hazard to say that the entire history of Marxist-Leninist social change has known few other methods, leading me to say further that a sober analysis of that history points to a struggle for supremacy, not only over the bourgeois ruling class, but also against the working class and all other oppressed peoples, against any and all formations that escape the control of these so-called vanguard groups. Thus, their mantra of doing everything to seize power for the working class and oppressed is a farce. If there has ever been a Marxist-Leninist vanguard party that has found itself in power and did not subsequently follow the script, I'm not aware of it. While arguments can always be made to rationalize why it was necessary to resort to such measures, and many such arguments do make sense initially, a closer look always seems to force adherents to fall back on the mantra of the flawed individuals who did not hold true to the principles of democratic centralism. These are wide open to interpretation and manipulation in order to seize the initiative in a struggle for domination, as opposed to trying to make concrete analysis of concrete conditions as V.I. Lenin instructed. Note that, his parenthesis, Russell Maroon Choates does feel he's also influenced by Lenin. I'd reached these conclusions on my own. Later, I was astounded to learn that the Marxist giant C.O.R. James, the author of the theory that explains state capitalism, and the mentor of the African revolutionaries Jomo Kenyatta and Kwame Nkrumah, who brought both Kenya and Ghana out of colonialism, as early as 1963 had said, now this is C.L.R. James, a black West Indian Marxist, this is C.L.R. James speaking in Russell Maroon Choate's book, we have repudiated the conception of the vanguard party. That conception ruined the socialist movement and the movement of the proletariat for a generation. The vanguard party conception ruined all attempts to form a Marxist party in the U.S. So, parenthesis, understand that C.R. James is still arguing for a Marxist party in the U.S., but he's arguing it's the theory of the vanguard party that he disagrees with, and contributed substantially to the catastrophes which have befallen it. What has happened is that their whole outlook and mentality have been dominated by the concept of a vanguard party which had to teach the people about Marxism and other such matters, which would make the people understand that they, the preachers, were the ones who should be followed as they were the leaders of the socialist revolution. The whole Stalinist experiment, the whole Nazi regime, are not the result of evil men. They are the result of the drive towards the unification of the executive and political organization of all aspects of the state. Democratic centralism's historical modus operandi, which is supervised and forced by the vanguard party. This is from C.O.R. James, Marxism for Our Times. Now we're back to Russell Maroon Choates. At the same time, history has shown that such ruthless methods are effective if the objective of those who use the DC methods was simply to seize power. Then their record during the 20th century is impressive. It has proved itself as brutally efficient and capable of outdoing anything bourgeois forces are capable of. Nevertheless, in the end, those who gained power using democratic centralism have always ended up using it to defeat the aspirations of the workers and oppressed, and to subsequently install themselves as new oppressive ruling class. How could it be expected to produce any other outcome? DC concentrates more power in the hands of a relative few than any mechanisms that the masses themselves, who practitioners of DC purport to be serving, can muster. It's a recipe that's bound to create conflict given the vagaries of flawed human beings. Stan Goff, in his masterful Full Spectrum Disorder in 2004, believes that DC, as practiced by Lenin and his Bolsheviks, did have a democratic basis, whereby an open and intense democratic struggle was carried out in order to arrive at positions and policies, then all the party workers would move in a decentralized, free-willing manner to make possible the implementation of those decisions in the teeth of czarist repression, which ultimately had the effect of centralizing their combined efforts. Only later did these methods change, leading to an all-around centralization and very little democracy, if any. Without a doubt, any number of other Marxist-Leninist-Maoist-style groups have had similar experiences. Yet if the clear historical tendency is to always gravitate towards less democratic and more oppressive forms of control, then quite frankly, for one to suggest that we can use historical materialism to formulate correct ideas, theories, and plans for liberation by using democratic centralism is ludicrous. So, understand I'm not yet getting to my agreements and disagreements with him, but he's trying to argue so far that his struggle is with the concept of democratic centralism. It's not with the concept of armed struggle. It's not with the concept of the influence of Lenin. It's not against the theory of a Marxist party, but it is a criticism of excessive centralization in the hand of a party elite, which turns itself into a state elite, which then combines the party and the state, both controlled by the same party. And that's the particular argument that he's arguing against. Okay, now this is him again. Him being Russell Maroon Schultz. We're urging you, if you like this reading and you like his thinking, to come out on Thursday night, May 27th, at the Southern California Library at 6:30 to 7, to meet his daughter, Teresa Schultz, to meet several other people that I'll tell you about, and to learn more about Maroon's book. Now, if you want to come to the Southern California Library, and if you want to give me some comments on the show, let me know you're out there, you can send comments to Eric at Voices from Front Lines. We finally got that set up. It's also on our website, which we'd like you to check out, www.voicesfromfrontlines.com. It's very important for me and those of us who are on the show to know, again, we've been getting really great emails from a lot of you, and we're going to be sending you this invitation to the Russell Maroon Schultz book signing. But if you're interested, send me the email at eric@voicesfromfrontlines.com. So now I'm going to continue with Russell Maroon Schultz from his book, Maroon the Implacable, The Collected Writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. Now here we are, it's called The Contemporary Situation. Here we are at the beginning of the 21st century facing a global crisis unknown heretofore in the entire history of humankind. The threats to our collective existence are so multidimensional that it would take many pages to detail them all. Consequently, I'll limit myself to those that I believe are paramount in helping us to break out of the self-imposed mental roadblocks that hinder our efforts to move forward. The main threat to humankind, to the flora and fauna, and to our entire biosphere is capitalist imperialism, a total out-of-control, predatory global system of accumulation and oppression that's on a collision course with the limitations of our planet, daily devouring children, women, people of color, the poor, workers of all stripes, wildlife, and the environment in pursuit of profits. All of our problems rest primarily on artificial divisions that have been engendered between different oppressed groups for hundreds of years, divisions based on gender, race, ethnicity, culture, geography, sexual preferences, age, and similar factors. These divisions have been fostered historically by those who have sought to use them in their pursuit of power and material gain. Under imperialism, the overwhelming majority of our planet's humans are ultimately workers. Thus, Marx's address to the International Working Men's Association still holds true today, although we underestimated the degree of opposition the workers would face and the length of time it would take for them to overcome all of the obstacles in his path. Marx, superb analyst that he was, remained trapped by Eurocentric predilections. He overlooked or dismissed important workers' struggles that fell outside of Europe. At the very least, he failed to study them with the same intensity devoted to those in Europe, upon which he primarily bases otherwise well-grounded analysis. That set in motion a process by which others willfully neglected to formulate a proper evaluation of those other struggles even today. A thorough study, evaluation, adaptation, wherever applicable, and understanding of some of the workers' struggles will help us move forward in a struggle against imperialism. There we'll find proven, workable alternatives to the flawed DC forms of organizing, ones that mirror Stan Goff's analysis of the strength of the early Bolsheviks. So now, I'm going to read you just a couple of case studies because I want to make sure that we have time. First, he's going to tell us about Suriname. We must slay the Hydra. That was the Dutch imperialist's main concern in Suriname from the earliest days there. Hydra in Greek mythology, a many-headed monster whose heads regrew when struck off, was finally killed by Hercules. It is also the largest and longest constellation in the sky, but with no particular bright star. So just to start with the disgusting Dutch imperialists, or opening up this conversation. On the northern coast of South America, this tropical country borders Guyana and French Guiana and fronts the Caribbean Sea, with Brazil to its south. In total landmass, is more than one-third as large as Cuba. The first European interlopers to visit the area were the British, who were followed by the Dutch. The territory frequently changed hands between them, but the Dutch were the main imperial power to occupy the country from the mid-1600s up to the 1970s. Wow. Throughout this period, the overwhelming majority of the indigenous Amerindian population were either suppressed, forced to flee to no less hostile areas, or exterminated. The Dutch were one of the world's major imperial powers at that time, vying alongside the British, Spanish, Danish, Portuguese, and the French for control of North and South America, the Caribbean, and other parts of the world. The Dutch West Indies Company was one of the first corporations in the world. In Suriname, it launched plantation-based production of cash crops on a large scale, using enslaved workers imported from different parts of Africa. Added to that were a number of other plantations run by other European, quote, entrepreneurs, along with their overseers, shopkeepers, militias, artisans, administrations, bureaucrats, sailors, and a small percentage of mostly poor white women who had been exiled from Europe. Compared to the enslaved Africans and the suppressed Amerindians, one could compare everyone else, except a small number of plantation operating entrepreneurs and administrators, with what we today recognize as the labor aristocracy and petty bourgeois of the technologically advanced countries. Those elements were fully dependent for their livelihood and for their protection of their persons and property from the enslaved workers and remaining indigenous people on the Dutch military, militias, the imperial court, and the big mercantilists. I make this comparison because we all too often fail to point out that the enslaved Africans were transported across the Atlantic to assume the role of workers, and just about everyone else associated with their plight were also, first and foremost, other workers, similar to a plight today. And the issue of race did not, could not, change this basic fact. So keep that in mind as we develop this analysis. Among the Africans were many different ethnic groups from different areas of the continent, all speaking different languages, and with many of these Africans, and with many varied religions and cultural practices. To get an idea of the stratification of these Africans, consider the fact that they all had dark skins meant next to nothing to them in terms of solidarity. Where they originally came from, everybody had dark skin, friends and enemies alike. Further, it was the practice of the plantation owners to try to purchase workers from different backgrounds in order to keep them divided as much as possible. And because the work was so brutal and the food so inadequate, most plantations were really death camps, where the African workers were literally worked to death in a few years, only replaced with newly imported enslaved workers, who would also go on to make handsome profits for the owners. Thus, the turnover itself was a powerful check on the formation of any solidarity between the enslaved workers. But be that as it may, almost from the first importation of enslaved Africans, they developed a tradition of flight from slavery. Africans ran away to the forests, swamps, and highlands. These fugitives came to be known as Bush Creoles, Dutch for Bush Creoles, or born in the forest, and later Bush Negroes. We call them Maroons throughout study, as a generic name that has come to be an accepted way to describe fugitive enslaved people throughout the Western Hemisphere. Thus, the author's name, Russell Maroon Schultz. I'll repeat his definition. A generic name that's come to be an accepted way to describe fugitive enslaved people throughout the Western Hemisphere. Everywhere we look in that part of the world, we witness these collective Maroons developing and using every effective form of decentralized organizing that only served to help them defeat their former slavers, but also to remain autonomous from all unwanted overseas for hundreds of years until our time. It must be remembered that the Suriname Africans were from many different backgrounds, so when they would get together as Maroons, that reality would have to be factored in. They had to organize using democratic methods, and the glue that held them together was their collective focus on defeating their enslavers' attempt to control them. This is what centralized their efforts. There remained, however, one class within these communities which was different. Those Africans who did not flee, but were forced by Maroon raiders to leave the plantations. These individuals did not enjoy a say in community affairs until they had proven themselves. But as a general rule, individuals and small groups would flee the plantations to join the Maroons. On some occasions, large conspiracies were organized that saw the enslaved workers prepare the groundwork for Maroon guerrillas to raid plantations and liberate scores at a time. This example shows how decisions could be arrived at by truly democratic means and then carried out in a centralized manner by otherwise decentralized groups long before our Bolsheviks. Just another minute here. He's doing very interesting stuff. He's arguing about the dialectic between decentralization and centralization. He's not arguing against the need for a centralized attack, for instance, on the enemy. But he is definitely arguing for more independence and initiative inside revolutionary organizations. Over a 150-year period, the various Maroon communities of Suriname would wage a guerrilla war with the Dutch and English slavers to remain free. Today in Suriname, their direct descendants still occupy the land on which their ancestors fought, and most of them have never been enslaved, dating from a time even before the United States signed its own Declaration of Independence in 1776. 818-985-5735 if you want to comment on Trayvon Martin on Russell Maroon Show. Even as this is written, they remain more autonomous for the government of Suriname, which gained its independence from the Netherlands, whose Dutch ancestors were discussing in 1975. That's outrageous, 1975. In fact, the descendants of the early Maroons were again forced to fight another guerrilla war against the newly independent government in 1980, a successful effort on the part of the Maroons to maintain their autonomy and control over the lands they've historically occupied. Their decentralized methods had their drawbacks. Their enemies in the imperialist camp were able to manipulate various Maroon communities into signing treaties that gave them their freedom from enslavement and land to use in exchange for cooperation, hunting down and capturing other fugitives. In this way, the enslavers could avoid the all but useless wars designed to capture or kill the skillful Maroon guerrillas. Everyone in the Maroon guerrilla communities, including the women and children, could and would, at the drop of a hat, pack their belongings and escape to prearranged and fortified alternative settlements, while the men, and some women, busied themselves in fighting rearguard actions against the pursuing colonial soldiers. It turns out, however, that although the treaties did solve some of the imperialist problems, the Suriname Maroons never fully fulfilled their obligations to help the imperialists hunt and capture other Maroons. A narrative of the Dutch forces' generations-long wars designed to either capture or kill the bony Maroons is instructed in that regard. By the mid-18th century, and I'm reading from the book Maroon the Implacable by Russell Maroon Schoetz, the Dutch had been forced by over 100 years of Maroon guerrilla warfare to sign treaties with three of the most powerful Maroon communities, the Njuka, the Saramaka, and the Matamwai. All these Maroon communities had evolved over generations from fugitive Africans of many ethnicities into new ethnicities that adopted these names. Most importantly, they had soundly defeated all of the imperialist forces sent to capture or kill them, while continuing to expand their numbers and offer an ever-growing threat to the Dutch colony. The treaties came with yearly gifts of all kinds that the Dutch would deliver to the Maroons. Textiles, pots and pans, guns, powder, axes, knives, mirrors, nail, liquor, and just about anything agreed upon during the periodic sit-down between the parties. The underlying objectives of the imperialists were to rid themselves of a dangerous enemy and turn them into valuable allies. We have a few people on the phone. I'm going to read one more paragraph. Yet once it became known to the still enslaved African workers that they could no longer rely on the Njuka, Saramaka, and Matamwai for refuge and protection, they began to seek out smaller Maroon communities. In the early 1700s, one of these small groups was headed by an African named Asikan Sylvester. Born into this group was a child called Boni. His mother was a fugitive African and his father either African or Amerindian. Subsequently, the group chose Boni to be its new head after Asikan became too old. This group of Maroons would eventually become known to the Dutch as a new center of resistance, and for the next two generations, Boni would lead them. They would become known to history as the Boni Maroons, transforming themselves into an ethnicity. Thus, the Boni Maroons became a new contentious force, while the imperialists thought they were suppressing resistance by the signing of treaties with the other Maroons. Consequently, the imperialists would not sign any more treaties with either the Bonis or any other Maroons, which lasted to the end of the slave period. Boni, for his part, would lead his group to aggressively wage war on the imperialists until his death in his mid-60s. There's much, much more to read. I'm reading and have been reading from Maroon the Implacable, The Collected Writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. Please come out and get to know his daughter, Teresa Schultz, who's working to get him first into the general population. Remember, he's in solitary confinement for over 30 years. And then to get him out of prison and join the rest of us, I'll be speaking, as will Teresa Schultz, and as will several other people at the Southern California Library. Okay, let's go to the phones. Phil, how you doing? Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say free all class war and political prisoners, first and foremost. Secondly, about the subject matter of maroon societies and autonomous regions, I would say that although very, very inspirational, these maroon societies and various countries of the Americas are very inspirational, but I think more effective, the American Civil War should be seen as a revolution and a more thoroughgoing way in which to transform the society and its mode of production from slavery to capitalism, set the stage for, obviously, maybe not obviously to your listeners, but obvious to me, a worker society or a worker state.
Well, hold it right there, Phil, because that's your basic premise, and yeah, I understand that you disagree with Maroon, so that's your point that you made, and I hope people come out on June 27th to Russell Maroon Schultz's ideas. And let's go to our next listener, and keep your remarks in the 1 to 2 minute so that a lot of our listeners can come in, okay? Looks like we have Rick from Sherman Oaks. Please respond to either the Trayvon Martin article that you heard or the Russell Maroon Schultz reading. How you doing, Rick?
Great, and I really appreciate the reading. It's really, it's a learning experience because I never knew anything about that, and it's really interesting, and I appreciate that you're courageous enough to just read something which could be looked at as dry radio, you know, but it's very hip. I like it. And just one quick observation off the bat is it seems like that might have something to do with Black American music in the United States. I got a gal named Boni Maroney.
Very, very interesting. I'm serious. No. Listen, I totally understand what you said. Let's check it out. There must be something better than Google, but
we gotta check that out.
Send me an email. Send me an email at eric@voicefromfrontlines if you find out that illusion. You got one more minute. What's your next profound thought?
Well, I don't know about profound, but it seems to me like it's interesting. I've centered my learning about mostly about Israel Palestine as well as a few other things, and the phenomena of the settler state, you know, South Africa, Northern Ireland, Israel, and the like. And I think that's the key to understanding Israel-Palestine, is the nature of the settler state. And what you were describing about how the Dutch were trying to make these treaties and buy off, you know, some of the Maroons and have them fight one against the other, you know, one does see repeated in these settler state struggles, for example. You know, the most obvious, maybe one of the first, was the Northern Ireland, where they took people who could never, and this is a little different, they bought off some people by taking Scots, you know, and who were Protestants, and sticking them into the English struggle to conquer Ireland, because they knew, and this is the twist of settler states, they knew that they would never assimilate because they were a different religion and a different nationality, similar maybe to the Jews, you know, in Israel and the Middle East, and the whites in South Africa, etc. So I'm just kind of interested in what I can learn from what you were talking about in that phenomena, and see if it's applicable to this other phenomena, parallel phenomena. And maybe you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I do. I mean, one of the things that the primary analogy is that the oppressed are not inherently unified. So whether or not you believe in, which I do, in some form of conscious organizing, it's important to understand that what Maroon's talking about is he's debating whether he doesn't want to call it a party or they're calling it a political instrument. He's not simply arguing for people withdrawing from imperialism. He's talking about developing base areas, and that these base areas, like every other movement, have to be very ideologically developed. The issue of co-optation is infinite. The system, you have to remember, is not called the ruling class for nothing. They're not just the imperialists. They're a ruling class. They rule. And they go to college, Ivy League colleges, I'm serious, military colleges, in order to teach how do you suppress counterinsurgency, is, you know, against insurgencies. So they bring in the Scotch, or they realize that there's religious contradictions among the Catholics, or they infiltrate and they find out that there's egoist competitions between leaders. Or in this case, they, I mean, disgustingly, like the Dutch, you know, these horrible Dutch who are portrayed now as such hippies and cool people, but they built their whole society as a, not as a settler state, but their whole society was based on imperialism. But the point is that they brought in people of different ethnicities from Africa, of different languages. And as Maroon points out, one of the reasons why the indigenous people were originally so defeated politically at first by the Europeans is because before the Europeans came, as Maroon points out, they were only indigenous people. So they didn't say, hey, we're being attacked by the Westerners, because for thousands and thousands of years, they had different tribes, different conflicts among themselves. None of them practiced genocide, thank goodness, like the Spanish. But when the imperialists came, the first thing they try to figure out is what were the divisions among the indigenous people. So with that, I'm going to move on. Thank you very much. We got other calls. I'm going to try to go faster. Michael from Long Beach. Faster. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello. I'm very inspirational reading, as some of others have noted, but I have a question. Here is this country, we have a left, if you can find it, that are liberals who insist upon using right-wing reactionaries' vocabulary. They start by calling themselves conservatives, and we buy into it. They call themselves pro-life when they're mandatory pregnancy. And we have this huge number of people who seem to be completely, you know, I'm supposed to be on their side, and I am. I'm against mandatory pregnancy. I'm against...
Michael, I'm going to respond to this in a minute, and I'm asking your listeners to take something seriously, okay? This is a show that's primarily focusing on the liberation of oppressed people, primarily Black and Latino and Indigenous people inside the United States, and the oppressed people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So if you're listening to a book by a Black man, and whatever ethnicity you are, but especially if you're white, please don't call up the show and say, interesting reading, and let me tell you about something else. This Black man wrote a book. The least you could do is respond to what he has to say. If you don't want to respond by any ability to just say you learned something, look, I have lots of interesting, I have millions of thoughts about this book, but the guy is pretty brilliant. That's my main reaction, is he's both sitting in a solitary confinement cell, he's a pretty wonderful writer, and he's discussing something about the Maroons that I barely know. So if you're going to call, and I mean, if not, please hang up. If you're going to call and in good faith, try to respond with a question about what he wrote, not your opinion about some other subject. That's who we want to get on the line, okay? So with that understanding, I'm going to, maybe the callers are going away, but it's really okay. Should we try John in Pasadena? You're on trial. See if you can do it, John.
Thank you. I was going to say, on the Trayvon Martin case,
good.
Zimmerman has already been convicted in a civil of negligence, and the homeowners society of that, you know, community that he was supposedly protecting has paid Trayvon Martin's parents several million dollars. So I'm thinking this case is kind of reminding me of the OJ case, in the sense that it almost is often settled as a civil matter. It's not exactly a criminal case. There was, you know, mistakes made on both sides of the fence on that day. I would just leave it as a civil matter and let it go.
Well,
to me, the Dorner case makes more sense. They should pursue that if they want criminality, go after the LAPD, what they did to Dorner.
Well, thanks a lot, and I think that the point there is that we do, in my opinion, want George Zimmerman prosecuted and, in my opinion, convicted for cold-blooded murder. you have to remember that had George Zimmerman been arrested on the spot, charged with murder, we wouldn't even known about this case. It just would have been a really beautiful black kid who left the gated community and was killed by a person who stalked him and was a vigilante in his brain. The police picked the guy up, but instead, the police interviewed Zimmerman and let him go on the stand your ground law. They saw no grounds for prosecution. This prosecution is only taking place because of national and international pressure that the system is now cleaning up its act. So it's very important that they not just bring him to trial, but successfully bring him to trial. And public pressure on this case is going to be essential, which is one reason that I wrote the article. So we have one last caller. Now listen, folks, in 2 minutes, I'm going to do this, only because none of you have responded to it. For those of you who listened and liked the reading, I'm going to spend the last 2 minutes on a discussion of why you got to come out. First of all, Teresa Schultz, his daughter, has been working for at least the last 10 years to get our father out of solitary confinement. For some of you who have been in solitary confinement for a day or can even imagine what it's like, imagine what it's like to even be in a cell where the bastards even put on the lights for 27 hours, 23 hours a day. This man can't even sleep. In the midst of this, a very brilliant guy is writing wonderful, wonderful prose, poetic prose. Amiri Baraka said, this book is a very funky instruction manual on how to make revolution. So I hope we can see you on Thursday night, June 27th, at 6:30 in the evening at the Southern California Library to come out, buy yourself. The book is $20, and come out and, if you're interested, come out and get a copy of this terrific book. Meet his family. Meet a real live political prisoner who's a brilliant, brilliant writer. You won't meet him directly. You'll meet him through his writing. And with that, send me an email at eric@voicesfromfrontlines.com. So with that, we're going out. This has been Voices from the Frontlines. You've heard the reading of my article. We'd like to thank the folks at Color Lines and the editor, Rinku Sin, the other editor, Kay Wright, who worked with me on this piece. Please go on Color Lines, check out my article, and also check out, more importantly, many other important articles. I want to thank our engineer G, who is always on the other side of a glass and who brings a lot of very good energy to this show. We're really happy to be able to work with her every Tuesday at 4. And to Jeff Ray, and with that, see you later.